Imagine walking into your favorite neighborhood coffee shop.
Okay.
You go there like every single morning, and you always order the exact same thing. A nice, comforting, completely predictable vanilla latte.
Right, your daily routine.
Exactly. But today, you walk in, you place your standard order, and without even blinking, the barista hands you a habanero-infused espresso shot and a scrambled Rubik's cube.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they tell you that you have to solve the puzzle before you're allowed to take a sip.
I mean, that completely upends the implicit contract you have with that establishment. Right. You expect comfort, and you are handed this demanding, high-focus challenge.
Right. You're standing there thinking, like, wait, this isn't what I signed up for. I come here to relax.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, out of sheer curiosity, you saw the side of the cube, you take a sip, and against all odds, it is the most incredible coffee experience you've ever had.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks. Because that whiplash of expectations, followed by the realization that this radical new formula actually works, is exactly what the gaming industry is experiencing today, April 21st, 2026.
It really is. We are looking at a highly anticipated release today that serves as a literal masterclass in how to pivot an established entertainment property without losing your core audience.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore the indie developer Ponkle. So back in 2022, they released a massive smash hit called Vampire Survivors, which went on to sell like over 10 million
It was
copies.
huge everywhere.
Completely ubiquitous. And today they dropped their first official spin-off, but instead of just making, Vampire Survivors Part 2, they have completely flipped the genre on its head with a new game called Vampire Crawlers.
Yeah, they really took a risk here.
They did. So whether you are a hardcore player looking for a new obsession or just someone fascinated by bold business strategy and IP expansion, this release is a masterclass in reinventing a brand.
To really grasp the magnitude of what they've done today, though, we have to look at the baseline they're pivoting away from.
Right, the original game.
Yeah, the original Vampire Survivors was practically synonymous with low cognitive load. It basically mainstreamed the entire auto shooter genre.
For those who might not have played it, an auto shooter is exactly what it sounds like. You drop into a 2D map, and your only job is to walk around,
Just steering.
just steering. The game automatically fires all your weapons for you. It's incredibly hypnotic. You just guide your little pixelated character through these swarms of monsters, watching the flashing lights, collecting gems,
You could play it while listening to a podcast or.
watching TV. Yeah.
Yeah.
It demanded almost nothing from you mechanically.
And that low barrier to entry is largely why it sold 10 million copies.
Yeah.
But today's release, Vampire Crawlers, completely abandons that casual framework.
Completely.
It has transitioned into a first-person shooter roguelike deck builder.
I mean, just saying that string of words out loud sounds exhausting.
It's a mouthful.
It is. It's a massive leap. Let's break down that terminology for a second because it is dense. When we say roguelite, we're talking about a very specific gameplay loop, right?
We are. So in a roguelite, you are playing distinct individual runs. And in crawlers, these runs last about 20 to 30 minutes through randomly generated dungeons.
Okay.
If you die during that run, you experience permadeath, meaning you lose the weapons and cards you gathered during that specific session, and you just have to start over from the beginning.
But it's a roguelite, not a roguelike, which means there is a meta progression system, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even when you die, you get to keep some overarching currency to buy permanent upgrades, which makes your next run slightly easier.
Okay, that softens the blow a bit.
It does. And the game utilizes difficulty scaling, so the deeper you survive into these random dungeons, the tougher the enemies become, but the loot gets exponentially better to match.
So the structure is classic roguelite, but the physical demands placed on the player are what make this pivot so aggressive to me.
Oh, absolutely.
You're no longer just steering a character from a top-down perspective. You are in first person. You have to manually aim your weapons. You have to actively dodge incoming attacks from all sides, manage your resources, and make these split-second tactical decisions while being swarmed.
It's a lot.
I have to stop you there and push back on this, actually, because looking at this from a business and audience retention perspective, it just seems baffling.
How so?
Well, I play casual games specifically to unwind. If I am part of that 10 million strong fan base that fell in love with a hypnotic, lazy river type of game, and the developer suddenly tells me I need to manually aim, navigate a 3D space, and juggle complex tactics, I'm just going to uninstall it.
Do you think it's too much?
Throwing a relaxed audience into a whitewater rafting simulator while asking them to do their taxes sounds like commercial suicide. Like, how did they not immediately alienate their entire player base?
Now, what's fascinating here is how Ponkle anticipated that exact psychological friction.
Mm.
They knew the mechanical leap was terrifying, so they constructed this really brilliant safety net. They retained the spirit and the aesthetic of the original game, even while completely abandoning the mechanics.
Meaning, what, they kept the visuals identical?
Yeah, they kept the core aesthetic. The recognizable pixelated characters, the familiar enemy sprites, the exact same visual style, and that underlying feeling of starting a run very weak and becoming ridiculously overpowered by the end.
Oh, I see.
Think of it like learning to drive a manual transmission car. If someone throws you onto a busy multi-lane highway, the complex mechanics of clutching and shifting will completely overwhelm you. You'll just panic.
Oh, for sure.
But if you learn to drive that same complex manual car on the quiet streets of your own neighborhood, the familiar environment drastically lowers your anxiety. The mechanics are still hard, but you feel safe enough to try.
That makes a lot of sense. The familiar visual wrapper gives the player the psychological permission to engage with a steep learning curve. I can see that. Like, I know these pixelated bats. I know these sound effects. So I'm willing to push through the frustration of learning to aim.
Right.
But let's talk about that learning curve, because physical aiming is only half the battle. Here's where it gets really interesting. The deck building.
Yes.
The sources indicate this isn't just a shooter. You are actively managing a deck of cards. But how does that actually work? How do you physically play a card while you're holding a gun in a first-person shooter?
Right. So this is the intellectual load of the game, and it operates entirely in real time.
Wait, real time?
Yes. You aren't pausing the game to look at a hand of cards, and you aren't playing them between rounds. You are drawing and activating these cards in the middle of a frantic firefight.
That sounds insane.
And the game utilizes an ecosystem of over 90 unique cards.
90 cards? That sounds like absolute chaos. How do you even begin to parse that kind of volume when a monster is charging right at your face?
Well, the developers meticulously categorize those 90 cards into 6 distinct groups to help the human brain process the information rapidly.
Okay.
There are 20 weapon cards, which instantly swap or upgrade the guns in your hands. There are 15 defense cards that deploy shields or grant armor.
Got it.
You have 12 mobility cards, which are absolutely crucial in a first-person shooter because movement is your primary survival tool. So these grant dashes or temporary speed boosts.
Okay, and the sources also mention 18 utility cards for various special effects. But the ones that really caught my eye were the 10 curse cards.
Ah, yes. The curses.
Introducing curses into your own deck seems totally counterintuitive.
It does, but the curse cards introduce a high-risk, high-reward mechanism. Playing a curse card might, say, massively increase the damage of the enemies for the next 30 seconds.
Why would you want that?
Because if you survive that 30 seconds, you get a permanent game-winning buff. It forces the player to evaluate their own skill and make a massive gamble, again, right in the middle of a shootout.
Wow. And tying all of this together are the 15 synergy cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Our sources highlight a specific mechanical example that shows just how deep this rabbit hole goes. If you are holding the fire bullets card and you manage to combine it in real time with the explosive rounds card, it doesn't just give you fire and explosions separately.
Right, it transforms them.
It fuses them into a brand new hidden effect called the Inferno Chain. So suddenly, shooting an enemy sets them on fire, which triggers a chain reaction of explosions that just cascades across the entire map.
It's brilliant. It heavily rewards players who experiment and memorize the underlying systems.
But I'm still hung up on the human element here. I mean, remembering which 2 cards create an inferno chain, deciding if I have enough health to risk a curse card, keeping track of my mobility cooldowns.
All while dodging.
Exactly. All while physically tracking and aiming at a swarm of vampires. It sounds like a recipe for absolute decision paralysis. In a normal card game, you sit at a table and think for 3 minutes. Here you have 3 seconds. How does a player not just freeze up completely?
It fundamentally comes down to how the brain operates within the flow state.
A flow state?
Yeah. When you are forced to make rapid decisions under extreme pressure, your brain stops relying on slow analytical thinking and shifts into pattern recognition.
Oh, like when you first learned to type on a keyboard. At first, you were staring at 26 individual letters, completely overwhelmed by the sheer number of options.
Right, hunting and pecking?
Yeah. But eventually, you stop looking at the keys, your brain just thinks the word, and your muscle memory executes it.
That is the exact mechanism at play here. The cards in Vampire Crawlers are heavily color-coded, and they use really distinct iconography.
Okay.
In the heat of battle, you aren't reading the text on a mobility card. You see a blue icon out of the corner of your eye, your brain recognizes blue means fast, and you just hit the bumper on your controller to activate it so you can dodge an attack.
Wow.
Making these complex choices under intense pressure is what elevates the experience from a mindless, repetitive shooter into a deeply strategic, almost rhythmic dance.
So the goal is to push the player so hard cognitively that they stop overthinking and just start feeling the rhythm of the mechanics.
Precise.
It's an incredibly ambitious design philosophy. But we have to look at reality. We know what the developers intended, but did the community actually embrace this stressful reinvention?
Well, the data we have paints a very clear picture of success. Back in February 2026, they released a demo during the Steam Next Fest, which is a massive online event where players can try upcoming games.
And the numbers for a demo in a pivoted genre are staggering. They saw over 500,000 downloads for that slice of gameplay.
500,000.
Yeah. But more importantly, it holds a 9 out of 10 user score, with 95% of the reviews being positive.
And if you dig into the qualitative data, what the players were actually writing in those reviews, they weren't just saying, oh, I love the art.
Yeah.
They were specifically praising the fast-paced FPS combat and the deep strategic layer of the real-time deck building. The community actively validated the exact mechanical leap that we thought might alienate them.
So they built a highly stressful, incredibly complex game, and the core audience loved the demo. But a demo is free. The obvious problem now is, how do you convince the broader casual gaming public to actually spend their hard-earned money on a full game that sounds like so much work?
Yeah.
And the answer to that lies entirely in the pricing strategy they unveiled today.
The barrier to entry has been deliberately minimized. The game released today across almost every major platform. We're talking PC via Steam and Microsoft Store, PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S, and the Nintendo Switch.
And mobile versions for iOS and Android are confirmed as coming soon.
Right.
But the price tag is what's really catching everyone's attention. It's launching at 9.99 cents or 9.99 euros or 1,200 yen. It's under $10.
Which is wild.
It is. Furthermore, the absolute trump card in this entire launch strategy is that it is available day one on Xbox Game Pass for both Ultimate and PC subscribers.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah.
This pricing strategy is a masterclass in the evolving economics of the modern video game industry and how subscription models are actually changing game design itself.
Because when a new AAA game costs $70, a consumer demands a guarantee. If I'm going to spend $70, I need to know definitively that I will enjoy the gameplay loop.
You want a sure thing.
Exactly. I'm not going to take a $70 gamble on a genre I might hate.
And that economic reality forces major studios to make very safe, predictable games. But Ponkle is manipulating the financial risk to serve their creative ambitions.
Okay, how so?
By launching a highly complex, potentially alienating game on a subscription service like Game Pass, where the player has already paid their monthly fee and can download it for free, or by pricing it at under $10 for a direct purchase, they completely eliminate the fear of buyer's remorse.
Oh, I see. It's like, I only paid the cost of a sandwich for this, so if the deck building is too hard and I quit after an hour, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. It removes the friction from the transaction. When players don't feel financially pressured to get their money's worth, they're infinitely more patient.
That's a really good point.
They are much more willing to sit down, embrace a steep learning curve, and let the game teach them its complex systems on their own terms. It gives a weird, hostile, or highly niched game the breathing room it needs to find its audience.
That makes perfect sense. The cheap price tag neutralizes the loudest potential complaint. It acts as a deliberate safety net to get people in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the sources do point out a few cons to balance out the pros. The pros are obvious. High replayability because of the roguelite loops, incredibly deep strategy with the 90 cards, and that very fair pricing.
Right.
But the cons explicitly warn about that steep learning curve. The sources also note you absolutely cannot play this casually while watching TV, which is a stark departure from the original.
There is also some polarizing feedback regarding the pixel graphics. While nostalgic for returning fans, seeing chunky 2D sprites in a fast-paced 3D shooter environment just isn't for everyone.
Yeah, it can look a little visually messy.
And understandably, for a day one release, it currently has significantly less overall content than the massive, multi-year updated original game.
Well, that's the reality of a new launch. But this brings us to the most ambitious part of our deep dive today. Everything we've discussed so far, The shift from auto shooter to FPS, the 90-card deck building, the $10 price tag. This single successful pivot with Vampire Crawlers isn't just a one-off experiment.
Not at all.
According to our sources, today's launch is merely step one in a highly aggressive multi-genre roadmap. Ponkle is attempting to turn a single game into an expansive ecosystem.
The timeline they've laid out for 2026 is relentless. Quarter two brings us Vampire Crawlers. Quarter three promises a second spinoff, and the genre is completely undisclosed.
I can't wait to see what that is.
Right. And then quarter four promises a third spinoff, which is heavily rumored to be a multiplayer experience.
And looming on the horizon in 2027 is the unconfirmed but highly anticipated Vampire Survivors 2.
Yeah.
This strategy feels like they're trying to build a Marvel Cinematic Universe, but instead of connecting different superheroes, they're connecting completely different gameplay genres.
That's exactly what it feels like.
So, what does this all mean? Is this the new blueprint for indie success? You have one massive breakout hit, and instead of just iterating on the same mechanics, you use that IP to aggressively colonize every other corner of the gaming market.
Well, this raises an important question about the longevity of intellectual property in the modern entertainment landscape. Our sources explicitly compare Ponkle's approach to what Supergiant Games achieved with Hades.
Oh, interesting.
Historically, the industry standard was simple. If you had a hit game, you made a sequel that was 10% bigger and 10% prettier, using the exact same mechanics.
But eventually, player fatigue sets in. I mean, you can only play the same loop so many times before you get bored, no matter how pretty the graphics get.
Ponkle recognized that trap. They are leveraging the immense financial war chest generated by their 10 million selling original to fund wild creative experiments. They are trying to squeeze more money out of the exact same auto shooter fans. They are actively cross-pollinating entirely different gamer demographics.
It's a brilliant funnel. The casual player who loves the idle original might tentatively try this frantic new FPS because they are attached to the characters and the lore.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the hardcore, sweat-inducing FPS player who normally ignores casual games will try Crawlers for its deep tactical combat, fall in love with the gothic aesthetic, and maybe go back and buy the original auto shooter just to experience more of that world.
It works both ways.
They are bringing diametrically opposed player bases under one massive intellectual property umbrella.
Through this strategy, the IP itself supersedes the genre. The brand is no longer defined by how you play it, but by the world you are playing in.
That is a fascinating shift in how we consume media. Let's briefly recap this journey for you, the listener, because we have covered a lot of mechanical and economic ground today.
We sure have.
We started with an indie developer taking a calculated but terrifying risk. They morphed a famously relaxing isometric auto shooter into a frantic, cognitively demanding $10 first-person deck builder. They engineered a brilliant psychological safety net to ease players into the difficulty, remove the financial barrier to entry via Game Pass, prove the concept with a wildly successful demo, and have now set the stage for a year of genre-bending spin-offs.
It is a phenomenal case study in audience management. So, for you listening, what stands out to you?
Yeah, what do you think?
When you analyze your own learning habits or how you choose to spend your free time, are you the type of person who prefers the comforting, low-stakes repetition of an established formula? Or are you drawn to the chaotic, high-focus, strategic problem-solving of a completely new challenge?
It's a great lens to look through when you choose your next piece of entertainment. And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over today, something that builds on our discussion but pushes into the future.
Okay, let's hear.
If an intellectual property can completely abandon its original gameplay mechanics, like the very buttons you push and the screens you look at, and still be massively successful, what does that actually mean for the concept of gaming genres?
That's a big question.
Are we entering an era where players are no longer loyal to specific types of gameplay? Are we just blindly following the vibes, the lore, and the aesthetic of our favorite franchises, completely agnostic to how the developers actually force us to play?
Wow.
It makes you wonder if the mechanics even matter anymore, or if it's entirely about the feeling of the world you're stepping into.
It fundamentally challenges everything the industry thought it knew about brand loyalty.
It really does. It all goes back to that coffee shop. Maybe it was never really about the vanilla latte. Maybe it was just about the familiar barista, the ambient music, and the feeling of walking through those specific doors. Thank you so much for joining us on today's deep dive. Stay curious, and we'll catch you next time.